One, two, three.
One, two, three.
One, two, three, four.
One,
two, three, four.
You're listening to part three of our exclusive conversation with Michael Nesmith here on monkeys.com and rhino.com. Towards the end of our chat, Michael mentioned that he had put together a special playlist of his favorite Monkees songs, which we will post here on monkeys.com. Here's Nez.
You know what I did the other day, just for my own enjoyment? I'll send it to you, as a matter of fact. And I named the playlist Mike. It's all of the songs that I did for the Monkees. And, you know... And it's very interesting how much like a band it sounds when you have kind of the focus of one author and my 12 string and Peter's bass playing and Mickey's drumming. They all had this real signature garage sound to it. It's probably as close to the real band as it ever got. It was fascinating to listen to. I was fooling with the playlist and just ordering. I wrote 26 songs for the Monkees, or I wrote 26 songs during the Monkees that were on Monkees records. And so I put that all. I just, you know, just to listen to it. And so there's a POV if you want one.
Talk soon turned to the first Monkee single ever to feature a Michael Nesmith composition, as well as the first to ever feature the band playing as a band. I asked Michael, what was it like the first time he heard "The Girl I Knew Somewhere" on the radio?
Well, it was just full of dramatic tension because we had Pontiac gave us GTOs to use for the year, you know, 66 and 67, and so I had this new white Pontiac GTO convertible with 3 2-barrel carburetors. I mean, white interior. I mean, it was just really a cool car. And I don't know whether I had it this time, but it sticks in my head like I did. And so I was living on Sunset Plaza with Phyllis, my first wife. You know, by that time, I was heartbroken, and I realized that we were in the middle of a power struggle, and that the music didn't really count, that the Brill Building wanted control of the thing, and it was about money, and it was about politics, and it was about power. And for me, the most important thing in my life is music. It's my access to the world of spiritual values and all, everything I consider important. That's my window into it. And so I was just, you know, beside myself. I had no way of venting it or doing anything with these emotions of sadness and loss and sorrow and not being able to have anything to do with me and realizing, well, you know, nobody wants to put together a band. But to Bob and Bert's everlasting credit, in my eyes, they had taken a stand against Kirshner, as you well know. And they had said, well, look, if the guys want to play, we'll let them play. And Kirshner had said, "No, we're gonna put this out, and the record's gonna be, I guess, a little bit me, a little bit you."
Walk out, Bill, don't you walk out? We got things to say. Talk out, let's have it talked out, and things will be okay. Girl, I don't wanna fight. I'm a little bit wrong.
So I said, well, Bert, here's the way this comes down. If that's going to happen, I got to go. We made "The Girl I Knew Somewhere." That's what we sound like. I'll put that up against that record. I don't know what the calculations of those records are. I don't know how the Brill Building works or who those, you know, how they make all that stuff happen. But I know how this happened. And that happened with the four of us sitting in the studio playing and working it out around a song that one of us wrote. So that feels real nice to me, and that's where I want to be. And if you guys can't be there, then I got to go. So it's basically, you know, that's my move. I'm going to quit if this is going to be the reality. You're going to just hand me the records, you know, on the set from time to time. I can't do it. It's over. So Bert told me I was crazy and then I was an idiot. And so everybody called and said, Bert tells us you're quitting. Bert tells us you're not going to do it. And I said, well, I'm going to, you know, I can't make this work this way. It's just not going to happen. So I had picked Phyllis up and we were driving up to the house in this pretty new car. And the disc jockey said, well, we've got the new Monkees single. And we're going to play it here in just a minute. And they were doing a whole lot of before announcing because at that time, a new Monkees record was a big deal, and they would use, you know, they'd use like a 10-minute run-up to it to gather listeners, and people would run to the radio and turn the radio on, and they would get these big bumps when they would play a new Monkees record.
321 KAJ Jet Set, top of the Real Dodge Steel Show. Stand by for that Monkees exclusive.
They were stacking the thing with commercials and everything, and Phyllis and I were sitting in the car, and I said, you know, if I hear a little bit me, a little bit you on the radio, that's it. I mean, we're done. And, of course, none of the legacy of the Monkees had happened at that time. We were still in the middle of the hurricane, so it was, you know, just basically back on the streets is what it would have meant. So we were sitting there listening to this guy go through the various things, and we were sitting there, and I kept getting that, you know, that feeling you get in the pit of your stomach when you start to get anxious and you start to think, oh, God, how's this going to go, like the end of a basketball game or some, you know, a jury trial where you're waiting for the verdict to come in. I was sitting there in this car thinking, oh, God, what's going to happen? Because if I hear the first chords of Little Bit Me, Little Bit You, I'm out of here. I mean, that's it. And then I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't have, you know, what can I possibly go do now if that's the case? And so I said, and here it is. Here's the Monkees' new record.
The Real Don Steele.
Okay, then.
93 KHJ.
Exclusively on Boss Radio World, premiering The Girl I Knew Somewhere, Monkees.
You tell me that you've never been this way before. You tell me things I know that I've heard somewhere.
And it was my guitar part on The Girl I Knew Somewhere. So that particular lick has a very fine resonance for me at that particular moment. I'll remember it all my life. Yeah, it's a breezy little pop tune. You know, I played that for John Harold, who was the guy that did the first recording of Different Drum.
Mm-hmm.
And I played Different Drum for him, kind of a country blues. And he said, yeah, that's really good. You got any more songs? And I said, well, yeah, here's one I wrote called Girl I Knew Somewhere. And he said, oh, that's awful. He said, that's a pop song. I said, well, yeah, kind of. I mean, it's for a pop band, appropriate for the time. But I liked that record. I thought it was pretty good. And by the way, in the stack, you know, the Mike record, it sounds good.
Now, what about the Mike sung version of that? Had you heard that before?
Well, you know, I forgot that happened, Andrew. I didn't realize that there was a Mike version of it until Allison Andrews. And she said, I want your vocal. I said, Allison, you know, God loves you, but I did not put a vocal on it. She said, yes, you did. I said, I didn't. I said, Mickey sang that song. She said, no, he didn't. You sang it. I said, Allison, you're just wrong. I never sang that song. She said, you sang it. I have it. I own it. And I said, well, look, you know, maybe you're mistaking me. So until she actually found it, and I had forgotten totally that I ever sang that song. Because the first one I heard was Mickey singing it. We were all pretty uniformly centered around the fact that Mickey sang the best, had the best pop voice of us, you know, and that David was the kind of the lead guy, and I was always really comfortable with that. I enjoyed the way Mickey sang, and so that was real easy for me. I never had any designs on being the lead singer, that was for sure.
The Mike sung version of Girl I Knew Somewhere is featured as a bonus track in two different mixes on the new deluxe edition of Headquarters, available right here from Monkees.com and Rhino.com. Michael Nesmith mentioned another track off of the new Headquarters deluxe edition that particularly struck his fancy.
It was fascinating for me to hear the Nine Times Blue thing that you drug up out of the demo archives of Screen Gems, I guess, that's on the Headquarters record. Victoria listened to it and said, you sound like Hank Williams. I said, well, duh. you know, major influence. And I didn't realize how much I sounded like Hank Williams. That was before I had my tonsils out. You know, I still had that real throaty voice sound to it. I sounded like a real, you know, country blues singer.
There's a certain something in the way you looked at me and said you'd stay that let me know that I was out of line. But I didn't know what else to do, and like a fool I tested you by demanding things of you which weren't mine.
I mentioned to Nez one of my favorite bonus tracks off the deluxe edition of the Monkees' debut album, a demo from Screen Gems of Propinquity.
Oh, and you know what I liked about that? I liked the way I played guitar on it. That was an old 12-string that I had. It had a rolling flat pick technique that I was working on at the time that sounded really good with that. And also, I realized, which I don't know what happened, but I play a B minor in that instead of the 5. You know, since I've been grown up, I play G, C, A minor, D. And always went to the D, but on the original one, I never went to the D. I went to the B minor instead of the 5, and it makes it a really interesting, much more interesting tune.
I've known for a long time the kind of girl you are, all the smile that covers teardrops, the way your head yields to your heart, all things you've kept inside that most girls couldn't bear. I've known you for a long time, but I've just begun to care.
Well, country blues, you know, I mean, it's the blues moved over to accessibility to my cultural roots, which are basically, you know, poor white, and just a different sensibility. But having access to the blues through the folk music was kind of a wonder. And of course, that was about the same time that Dylan had paved the way for all of us to do that. So I was exploring that territory. I still love that kind of music, even though I'm up to my eyeballs in loops and computer music and remixes and stuff these days. You know, I'm forever going back and digging out these great pieces of blues music and the way it was played and structured. I think those are building blocks that will be with us for another century.
As things went down in our conversation, I mentioned one of my favorite Michael Nesmith records, Magnetic South, and how I just found a version of this released in Japan in quadraphonic sound.
Oh my God, where did you get it?
Well, it came out on vinyl in Japan, and it is so different. It's got fuzz, pedal steel, and different vocals, and all kinds of amazing stuff.
It does?
Yes.
I don't remember that part. Have you got a copy?
Yeah, I've
got it. It was called Matrix, four-track Matrix. I mixed that, you know, the same way that I mixed the Tropical Campfires and the Garden for Dolby Surround. I mixed, I think, Loose Salute. I guess maybe it was only Loose Salute for Quad. It was called Quad. And they set that up for me in RCA Studio A, the big studio. And they set it up. They did the whole Quad thing because they were just sure this was where it was going to go. And so I was basically mixing a kind of a surround thing for that. But I had no idea that any of that product was still extant. I thought it had all been ground up. The only thing that I ever found that was even slightly a remnant of it was an old 8-track, an old Loose Salute 8-track that was in Matrix Quad Matrix. Unbelievable. Well, you know what I got to do? I got to look around on eBay and see if there's an old Quad player around or something. What they had done was they had come up with a way to take the stereo signal and shoot it into four different four different directions electronically. That's what it was. And they encoded it. And that encoding, if I'm not mistaken, Andrew, that encoding ultimately became the Dolby signal. And I got a full quad system. It was called quads, and they gave it to me for free. Wow, I wonder whatever happened to that.
And as we wrapped up our conversation, talk soon turned from old technology to the cutting edge of computers. The man who I credit with actually getting me to log on to the internet, Michael Nesmith, explained that I would need something a little bit better than what I had to experience the full reality of VR 3D.
What you have to do is you have to have a pretty good game box. I mean, you can't, this is leading edge technology, so it's not the province of a laptop. It's not even really the province of an office computer. Mm. You know, gamers have these big monster PCs, Windows XP on them and some, you know, ultra meg video card and stuff, and you really need one of those in order to stay alive in this. But even if, you know, if you can get kind of close to that, you can get a sense of the experience. And I think if you ever had it, it's not describable in words. I've never been able to tell anybody about this, like I said to you a minute ago, that said, oh, yeah, well, that was just like you described it. I mean, once you see it, it is so radically different than the mental image that one gets of it, that it has to be experienced in order to really understand it. So if you can get in and you can get yourself next to a big computer, a big PC that's got plenty of horsepower, I think you're in for a real surprise.
Definitely look into VideoRanch.com's VR3D and experience it for yourself. This is Andrew Sandoval signing off for Monkees.com and Rhino.com. Enjoy the new Monkees reissues that are available of The Monkees, More of the Monkees, Headquarters, Pisces Aquarius, Capricorn & Jones Limited. And also look for future Rhino Monkees releases here on Monkees.com.